Would anyone like to ask a question before I start? Okay. In that case, I'll go back to talking about spatial curvature. Last time, we were in the middle of generalizing the flat FRW metric to the curved FLRW metric, which involves introducing a new parameter, a constant k, with units of co-moving length to the minus 2, which is like a constant of nature that we measure. It appears in Friedmann's equations and has observable consequences. The way that I think about curvature geometrically is from the perspective of an explorer who lives in a spatially curved space experiences curvature as the statement that if they draw a circle with radius chi and circumference 2 pi r, that chi and r are not equal to each other. There are sort of two radial coordinates, one of which applies to radial measurements, and the other of which applies to transverse measurements. This situation can be described in a couple of different coordinate systems. The one that I find more intuitive, but it's not as algebraically simple as the other one, is to let chi be the radial coordinate of the coordinate system. These metrics that I'll write down are the spatial part of the FRW metric. So these are Euclidean 3 metrics, not Lorentzian 4 metrics. So here the curvature appears in this coordinate system. The curvature appears as the statement that the so this is the metric written down in spherical polar coordinates. That the factor in front of the angular factors is not chi squared, but rather this function sk of chi. Sk of chi is just another name for r that alternate notation is sometimes used. Is this this function? And then in general relativity, nonlinear changes of coordinates are allowed. So you can make a nonlinear change of variable from radial coordinate chi to radial coordinate r. And there the metric looks algebraically simpler. I find the first form of the metric a bit more intuitive. I just find it more intuitive to label circles by the distance that you have to travel to reach them, not the circumference that they would have once you do reach them. But for purposes of calculations, either one is fine. In the second coordinate system, r is like a basis coordinate and chi is derived, and I'll just write down that formula for completeness. If you needed to know chi in this coordinate system, you would work it out like this. So far, I've just described the spatial 3 metric, the space-time 4 metric is still given by the FRW form. With a scale factor A of t. We just swap out the Euclidean 3 metric by this more complicated Euclidean 3 metric. One little comment here is that I like to take the curvature k to be a continuous parameter, whereas in many references, including the Bauman notes, k is assumed to be either 0 or plus or minus 1. Just to explain that choice a bit, if you're just studying the geometry of this metric, of the spatial 3 metric, then one can rescale coordinates so that this condition is always satisfied. Formally, this amounts to rescaling, I suppose, going to the FRW4 metric. Just to write that down formally, the FRW metric is unchanged if you rescale lengths by some constant lambda, correspondingly rescale the scale factor and also rescale the curvature. And so by appropriately choosing lambda, you can choose k to have these one of these values. The reason that I prefer not to do things that way is that it uses up the freedom that we previously used to set a equals 1 today. In other words, you have the freedom by rescaling a to either set a equals 1 today or to set k equals plus or minus 1, but not both. And I find it more intuitive to set a equals 1 today. If you set a equals 1, then you're defining co-moving distance to be a distance measured today. And if you set k to 1, then you're defining co-moving distance so that your ruler is the curvature radius of the universe. These are statements about the metric, so let me talk a little bit about dynamics. So I didn't derive this, and it's kind of a long calculation that requires building up properties of this metric. But just quoting the answer, spatial curvature appears on the left-hand side of Einstein's equations this way, or rather in Friedmann's equation. And the second equation of motion, which we've been taking at different points in the lectures to either be Friedmann's second equation or the continuity equation, are unchanged. At a cookbook level, curvature is a fairly minor change to our existing formalism. We already have components of rho that go as a to the minus 4, a to the minus 3, and a to the 0. And curvature just amounts to, if you put this term on the other side, including a effective component of rho that goes as 1 over a squared, as if it were a source of stress energy with an equation of state minus 1/3. In fact, let me write Friedmann's equation in lambda CDM this way. I've been writing Friedmann's equation in two different ways. So this is what I'll call the physics parameterization. The most natural way of writing down Friedmann's equation based on Einstein's equations. And then there's the astro parameterization, which looks like this. It's mostly historical convention, but it can be a little nicer for calculations. It's usually written this way. For now, I've carried over the curvature term to the other side and introduced the notation omega k to mean minus k over h naught squared. This is just the curvature scale today at A equals 1 relative to the Hubble radius today. Note the sign. Positive curvature corresponds to negative omega k and vice versa. So I'm sort of giving like the cookbook version of curvature where I don't really derive everything. And that's because curvature is something that we just don't see observationally. The bounds on curvature are consistent with zero and very small. I must confess that I forgot to look up the observational bounds, but in terms of this parameter, they're on the order of 10 to the minus 3, consistent with zero. So another way of saying that is that curvature is no more than a 0.1% contributor to the expansion history of the universe. But I want to emphasize some things that we haven't shown. In a short class, you know, I like to give a tour where I derive some things and not others, depending on my biases for which things I think are important. And if I do that, I like to just point out explicitly when the things that we didn't derive. So one thing we didn't really show is that this metric corresponds to the pictures that we drew earlier. When I first introduced curvature yesterday, I described positive curvature as a three-sphere, a three-dimensional analog of the usual two-sphere, with k equals 1 over the radius squared. And then for negative curvature, I drew this kind of saddle-like geometry. So I didn't really show that this metric we wrote down had anything to do with those pictures. Another thing that I think is conceptually interesting that we didn't show is that spaces with non-zero curvature have as much symmetry as k equals 0. I guess this is related to the first item. A Euclidean 3 space is a space with maximal symmetry in the sense that any two points are connected by a translation, a symmetry of the metric. And at a given preferred point, any two frames are related to by a rotation, which is also a symmetry of the metric. And these spaces have the same amount of symmetry. You can appreciate that for a sphere, that for any two points on the sphere, there's a symmetry of the sphere that brings them together. And then there's also, for any two coordinate frames at a point, a symmetry that rotates one into the other. But it's not obvious that there's some sort of saddle-like space with the same property. And we didn't show how that all of those symmetries follow from this form of the metric. And then finally, we didn't show that Friedman's equations are as claimed. If we had another lecture, I would go through and explain in detail why these are true. Okay. Next, I want to talk about, so that's all I'm going to say about curvature. Next, I'm going to talk about some example cosmologies. And all of my example cosmologies are going to be in lambda CDM with curvature for different choices of lambda and k. So throughout the examples that I'll present in a minute, I'm assuming this form of H of A throughout. So if you play with Friedman's equation for a while with different choices of the omegas, then eventually I think you'll figure out the following sort of nice intuitive way of thinking about the solutions that has a lot. It's like an analogy with balls rolling on ramps or particles moving in 1D potentials. So to really state this properly, I want to say that in all of our examples so far, so I'm going to suppose as an assumption that we can write before we solve Friedmann's equation, that we can write rho as a function of A in advance. So that's true in lambda CDM, but a little later in the class, we will see situations where this is not true. For example, when we do inflation, there'll be 2 degrees of freedom floating around. There'll be the scale factor, and then there'll also be an inflaton field. And rho will depend on both of them, and it won't be possible to write rho as some function of the scale factor in advance. In this case, there's this really nice way of thinking about Friedmann's equations, where you make an analogy with a particle moving in one dimension. And a 1D potential V of X. So here are some equations that need no explanation. If I have some particle X of T moving in a 1D potential, then the total energy is conserved, and the force on the particle, say it has mass 1, is given by minus V prime. So with some algebra, you can show. I might give this as a tutorial for tomorrow. Then you can write Friedmann's equations in an analogous form. Friedmann's first equation can be written this way. The first one is straightforward to see, and the second one requires a few lines of algebra. And these are the same equations. If I think of A of t as describing the position of a particle in the effective potential, minus A squared times rho with a constant in front, plus the curvature with a different constant. This analogy is useful because if you're interested in some given values of the omegas, you can quickly draw a picture of what V effective looks like, and then reason based on your intuition of particles moving in potentials or balls rolling on ramps, how the universe will evolve. So in particular in lambda CDM, I'll write the constant prefactors are not very important, but the powers of A will matter qualitatively for the solutions. Over two. And the signs. So I just call your attention to the plus sign sitting in front of the curvature, the minus sign sitting in front of the other terms, and the matter and radiation have negative powers of A, and lambda has a positive power of A. Same equations with. And the total energy set to zero. Total energy tuned to zero. Because in the first equation over here, instead of just having an integration constant on the right-hand side, I actually get zero. Okay. So the first example I want to consider is spatially flat cosmology with different values of lambda. Starting with the case lambda equals 0, I just get some terms with negative powers of a and a minus sign. So the V effective looks like this. And so if a particle evolves on this potential with total energy tuned to 0, then it will start. Well, the initial conditions say we start at the Big Bang, so it starts down here, and it rapidly moves at first. It rapidly evolves. And then A dot slows down, but never quite gets to zero, and the particle never like turns around and comes back. So this is how our universe would evolve if we didn't have lambda, which is what everyone expected to see in 1990 or so. So you would start off with a rapid Big Bang and then settle down into a decelerating phase of expansion, but the expansion would never stop. Let me label that curve lambda equals 0. Now, if lambda is positive, which is what was observed when the expansion history was eventually measured well enough, then this happens. And then your intuition about balls on ramps tells you that the universe starts in a Big Bang, rapidly expands at first, decelerates, but then starts accelerating and enters just a runaway phase of rapid expansion, accelerating expansion. That's what we see when we integrate Friedman's equations. The expansion goes as a decelerating power law at first with an exponent less than 1, then becomes exponential. If lambda is negative, then something really fun happens. I get a plus a squared term in V effective. This describes a bouncing cosmology, where you start in a Big Bang, and then when I roll up the potential, eventually I get here where the energy is 0, and I don't have enough kinetic energy to continue. Just like a ball on a ramp, it'll turn around and come back. The universe will end in a big crunch where it shrinks back down to zero size in a finite amount of time. One thing I didn't comment on before is that Friedman's equations allow a contracting universe with negative a dot just as well as they allow an expanding universe. Our universe is expanding, so we usually choose solutions with a dot positive. But Friedman's equations are time reversal invariant because they only involve a dot squared or a double dot. If I take one solution and then just reverse time, I get another solution. Example 2 is going to be positive lambda and arbitrary curvature, which has a kind of a fun historical significance. So if I start with zero curvature, then I get this curve, which is the same curve that I had in the other plot. So here's zero curvature lambda equals 0. This is our universe. If I start putting in positive curvature, then this curve moves up. If I move it up to the value where it just touches, then I get what's called the Einstein static universe. So I'll say that this is Einstein static value. So there'll be some unique value of k where this curve just touches v equals 0 on the y-axis. That's called the Einstein static universe. I'll just sort of define it by this picture. Historical significance of that was that that was like the first cosmology that Einstein wrote down. Einstein really hated the idea that the universe would be expanding and not be in a steady state. He thought that was pathology of the theory, I guess. And so he thought it was important to find a solution where the universe could just stay time independent forever. And that's non-trivial to do. And this eventually is the scenario that he came up with. He thought that staticness was a requirement. And that requirement forced you to have positive lambda and positive k. Later, when the expansion of the universe was observed by Hubble, he would call this his greatest mistake. After that, there was a long historical period where it was believed that lambda and kappa were both zero. And then in the 1990s, with better supernova data, lambda was observed to be non-zero, and in fact, a large fraction of our energy density today. But as far as we know, k is still zero. Now, if you make k a little bit bigger than the Einstein static value, then something interesting happens. One category of solution is a bouncing cosmology like we had before, where you start at the Big Bang, go up to this maximum scale factor, bounce back, and get a big crunch in a finite amount of time. But then there's also another solution that starts off at large A, at infinite scale factor, comes in from positive infinity, reaches some minimum value, and bounces back. So there would be two, in this case, there would be two possible universes depending on the initial conditions. There's a universe that, if this is like a space-time diagram, there's a universe that does this. Kind of a universe in a bottle that starts at zero scale factor in a Big Bang, grows and contracts and hits a big crunch. And then there's a universe like this. That starts out contracting, reaches the minimum scale factor, and then starts expanding. There's a range of scale factors in this scenario that are just inaccessible. It's just mathematically inconsistent to have a scale factor in this range because it's impossible to satisfy Einstein's first Friedmann's equation. Okay. There's one more topic. So the lectures will have three parts. The first part is the expansion history and geometry of spacetime. The second part is going to be thermal history. I'm almost done with the first part. There's just one more topic that I'll just introduce briefly because we won't use it very much, but it does come up a lot, so I wanted to mention it. And that is conformal time. Let me motivate the definition of conformal time as an interesting way of writing the FLRW metric. So we've been writing it this way, assuming spatial flatness for simplicity. Now, in general relativity, nonlinear changes of variable are allowed. And so you could switch to a different time coordinate. In particular, there would be nothing mathematically wrong with taking the scale factor A to be the time coordinate or the clock. Like you could change variables in this metric from T to A if you wanted to. A particularly interesting change of variable is defined by, is conformal time tau. And if you want, it's defined by the equation dt equals a d tau. Or if you wanted to, you could write a formula for tau. Oops. So this looks a bit artificial, but I'll interpret it physically in a minute. One nice property is that if I make this change a variable in the metric, then I can write the metric as a scale factor A times the Minkowski metric. Or now I've just one minor comment is that when writing the metric this way, I've written A as a function of tau rather than a function of t. Generally speaking, in general relativity, two metrics which differ by an overall scalar, which can depend on position, can depend on space-time coordinates, are called conformally related. This scalar function is called the conformal factor. So this calculation shows that the FLRW metric is conformally Minkowski, that's one way of saying it, or conformally flat is another way it's sometimes described. Another way of thinking about conformal time is that we've been drawing pictures like this, space-time diagrams in FLRW, where light cones are curved. They have the property that their slope is 1 over a. And a quick way of deriving that is to set ds squared to 0. The trajectories of null geodesics, or light rays in GR, always have this property that the differential metric element along the trajectory is 0. So in proper time, that condition that ds squared equals 0 looks like this, or equivalently dx dt is 1 over a. Conformal time has the property that if the y coordinate of the y-axis of the space-time diagram is now tau, then conformal time has the property that the light cones are just at 45-degree angles. And so if you're just concerned with drawing light cones and not with such nuances as how as the redshifting effect, how the frequencies of photons evolved, then if you use this time coordinate, you just get to pretend that your space-time is Minkowski. Another little difference is that, at least for lambda CDM, and this is a cosmology-dependent statement, in proper time, the universe lasts forever. There's no big crunch or end of proper time in lambda CDM. But in conformal time, there actually is a finite value of the conformal time when the universe ends. This is just a coordinate singularity in the sense that it's a coordinate asymptotes to a finite value, but the time experienced by an observer which carries a clock goes to infinity. Anyway, the reason that the light cones just go at 45-degree angles is that this calculation, ds squared equals 0, in conformal time just looks like this. And the a squared drops out, and you just get dx over d tau equals 1. Another way of thinking about conformal time is that the conformal time is the same thing as the co-moving distance that a light ray travels since the Big Bang. That's one valid time coordinate for the universe, just like the proper time is the value read by a clock that a co-moving observer has carried since the Big Bang. We'll occasionally use conformal time in a technical way, like when we do inflation. It'll turn out that the equations of motion for the inflaton field are just a little algebraically simpler in conformal time. There's just some factors of A that cancel, kind of like in this calculation. It'll occasionally be a change of variables that has some technical usefulness for us, but we won't use it a lot. That's like the end of the first third of the class, where we talk about expansion history and geometry. I'm going to shift focus now to talking about thermal history and thermodynamics. I think 20 minutes is a good amount of time to kind of give an introduction, like an outline, and just describe some of the results that we'll prove. Before I make that change, I'm going to raise these boards too. Pause for like general questions on the expansion history material. Yes.
Why does the time end for the conformal frame?
Oh yeah, I glossed over that. That's like totally non-obvious. So it's a cosmology dependent statement. One way of saying it is that there's just an integral that you can do that may turn out to be finite or infinite. So one way of writing the integral is if I want to calculate the total amount of proper time in the future in my cosmology, one way of writing that down is this way, h of a, integrated from 1 to infinity. That's because H is defined to be A dot over A. The question of whether this integral converges or diverges is just a completely cosmology-dependent statement. In lambda CDM, if you take the scale factor if the scale factor is large compared to 1, then H approaches a constant. So this will approach, if I'm just keeping track of whether or not the integral converges or diverges, I can write it this way, which does indeed, I can just forget about the overall constant, which does indeed diverge. In conformal time, there's another power of A. So I can write the integral of d tau. Let me write it this way. D tau is dt over A. And then I'll write that as, by the same change of variables before, dA over A squared H of A. Now if I assume lambda CDM, then H, where the integral goes from 1 to infinity, as before. Now if I assume lambda CDM, then H approaches a constant at large A, and so I can pull that constant out of the integral and disregard it for questions of convergence. And I get dA over A squared, which does converge. In hindsight, I should have shown that. Physically, what it means is that the proper time in the future being infinite, that's a good thing. If it were finite, there would be a problem. Like the law, we'd have some sort of singularity, like a big crunch. I guess our cosmology does have a big bang if you run the clock backwards, but it's nice that it doesn't have a big crunch. You'll notice in this picture that I drew these trajectories sort of asymptoting to a finite value. I drew the picture to illustrate that there's a finite causal horizon in the future. In lambda CDM, the universe exponentially expands at late times. So if you send out a light ray, like it gets to propagate forever. The total time in the future is infinite. But it's exponent. The universe is exponentially expanding underneath it, so it only ever makes it a finite co-moving distance. And that's the physical reason why the conformal time is finite. The conformal time, the total conformal time in the future of our universe, is just the total co-moving distance that a light ray would travel if we emitted it today. And in lambda CDM, that does turn out to be a finite number. Yeah, there's some non-obvious statements that I sort of hid in these plots. Like the in proper time, the Big Bang happens at a finite time in the past, but there's an infinite amount of proper time in our future. Whereas in conformal time, both the amount of conformal time in the past and the future are both finite. Another statement that I think I briefly mentioned in the first lecture is that the total future horizon for our lambda CDM parameters is about one-third the size of the total past horizon. So there are like galaxies that we can observe on our past light cone that we could never travel to, even if we invented faster than light or light speed travel today. They're just the same galaxy is outside our future causal horizon. Yeah, thanks. That was a really, really good question. Would anyone else like to ask another question? Okay, cool. Okay, so now in the last 15 minutes, I'm just going to kind of introduce the thermal history stuff. We get into the thermal history, there'll be a lot of theory that we have to build up. The first will be a couple lectures of theory before we can start making observable statements. So I want to give some sense of where the theory is going. As the universe expands, it cools as particles lose energy due to redshifting. For example, the temperature of the CMB that we observe today is 2.7 Kelvin, 2.726 Kelvin. But at an earlier time, the CMB would be redshifted by 1 over A. I didn't actually show that this was true for the whole blackbody spectrum, but it is true. It's easy to show if you write down the blackbody spectrum. Then if I take a blackbody at some temperature T today and just go back in time by blue shifting all the photons, then I get another blackbody whose temperature is related in this way. So if we went back to when the scale factor of the universe was a quarter, then the temperature of the CMB would be like 10 Kelvin. If you go back far enough, then the universe becomes a very hot place. So one thing that happens if you go back to when the temperature is around 3,000 Kelvin. So this happens when the scale factor is around 10 to the minus 3. But I'll generally find it more helpful to think of temperature as the time coordinate rather than the scale factor. It's just the time coordinate that decreases with time. Then a very interesting thing happens called recombination. Say I'm going to organize these this as a timeline where time runs this way. So after recombination at temperatures below 3,000 Kelvin, I'm going to erase this. The preferred state of the universe is a bunch of is neutral hydrogen plus free streaming photons. Before recombination at higher temperatures, the preferred thermodynamic state is just a plasma of protons, electrons, and photons. When the universe cools enough, the protons and the electrons in the plasma find each other and combine into neutral hydrogen. And this is the time in the universe's history when the CMB is formed, when the universe becomes transparent and the photons start free streaming through the universe. Those are the photons that we see today as the cosmic microwave background. This picture is a bit simplified because there are like some helium nuclei around and there's helium recombination that happens at a different temperature. Continuing to run the clock backwards, the next, another big thermal event that happens, happens at a much higher temperature when the universe is around 0.5 MeV, which you'll recognize as the mass of the electron. So prior to this, positrons and electrons are thermodynamically favored over a state where they have annihilated. So at low temperatures, you know, if I have a an electron and a positron, if they find each other, they'll annihilate into two photons. But if the temperature is high enough, then the reaction just runs both ways and neither side is favored. You just have a plasma that's full of protons, electrons, and positrons that all couple to each other. So this event in the universe's thermal history that changes the composition of the plasma, I'll call that, where is this diagram? E plus C minus annihilation. And then you get the idea. There are more thermal events like this that happen. The next one happens at a temperature of around 100 MeV, I guess, where this is roughly the rest mass of the muons and the pions. They all have masses around 100 MeV. At temperatures higher than this, the universe is a plasma that contains those particles in addition to the positrons, electrons, and photons. Let's call this mu pi annihilation. There's some events that I'm omitting from this history, like Big Bang nucleosynthesis and helium recombination. Initially, but I'll go back and talk about them later. Now, a famous prediction from 1960 or so. I tried with Google to find the original reference, and I actually didn't succeed in finding it. If anyone knows it, let me know. Is the existence of a cosmic neutrino background. Let me say that you might think that this sequence of events that I've just described has no observable consequences, that this is all happening at very early times in the universe's history. Since then, everything is thermalized. That's all been just washed out and reached thermal equilibrium. It would be hard to find now observational evidence that any of this happened. There is, however, one very interesting prediction. The prediction of a cosmic neutrino background, whose temperature is predicted to be this. The CNB temperature is the CMB temperature times this magic factor of 4/11 to the 1/3, or 1.95 Kelvin. So that's the theory prediction. And the observed value is 1.94 plus or minus 0.03 with current data, which is an amazing prediction, confirmation of the prediction. This magic, yes?
How come it doesn't depend on the neutrino mass?
The neutrino mass does matter in setting the energy density of the cosmic neutrino background today. The total energy density of the cosmic neutrino background is roughly proportional to the neutrino mass. The temperature, which I'll define better in a couple of lectures, has to do with the the number of cosmic neutrinos and their velocity distribution. That is predicted to be independent of the neutrino mass. That's something that I'll show later. We'll talk about the physics of the C and B in detail. Let me come back and give a better answer to that question in a few lectures. We'll explain where the 4/11 to the 1/3 comes from. But for now, I just want to comment that it has to do with the fact that the neutrinos, with two things. First off, if the temperature is high enough, neutrinos are coupled to the plasma. And then when the temperature gets low enough, they decouple. You might think that neutrinos just interact so weakly that they're never in thermal equilibrium with anything, the plasma that fills the universe. It turns out that at really high temperatures, like above an MeV or so, neutrinos interact with standard model particles quite a lot and are in thermal equilibrium. And so there's a decoupling event when neutrinos lose thermal contact with the plasma that happens somewhere in here. Between after muon and pion annihilation, but before E plus E minus annihilation. It's this timing that sets the factor 4/11 to the 1/3. If the neutrino coupling happened here, that factor would turn out to be 1. And if it happened here, earlier than the muon pi annihilation, then this factor would be, I believe, 1/6 to the 1/3. This observation is a pretty amazing confirmation that we knew what we were talking about when we drew this picture, this sequence of events has, in a very indirect way, this thermal history has an observational consequence.
But I'm kind of confused. You said it's 1.95 Kelvin, but the current temperature is 2.226.
Oh, yeah, that's the CMB temperature. So the theory of the CNB that I'll present in a few lectures predicts that the CNB temperature should be a little lower than the CMB temperature.
The change in letter.
So an interesting observation you could make is that the CMB is a powerful neutrino detector. Historically, neutrinos were found in the lab first, and then this prediction was made, and then it was observed. You could imagine it happening in the other order, and you could imagine discovering a particle through cosmology. In fact, there probably is such a particle, namely the cold dark matter. So we know from cosmology that there's a dark sector that consists of both neutrinos, a particle that we understand, cold dark matter particles, which are a type of particle that we don't really understand. In fact, neutrinos are a fairly small contribution to the total energy density of the universe today. Whereas cold dark matter is a large contribution. It's about 5 times the size of the standard model particles. Unlike the neutrinos, we don't really know what it is at a microscopic level or how it might be related to any of this thermal history. So I'll talk a little bit about models for dark matter, especially models which predict that the dark matter, which assume that the dark matter is some sort of thermal relic that was in thermal contact with the plasma at early times, and then decoupled or froze out at some point in the thermal history. Since I have 2 more minutes left, one comment that I do want to make is that when I say that the cosmic neutrino background is observed in cosmology, it's a very indirect observation. There are experiments that are trying to directly measure this neutrino background, like build detectors on Earth that would measure the cosmic neutrinos. They're predicted to exist in great abundance. They're just such low energy that the detectors aren't very sensitive. And direct detection of the cosmic neutrino background, I believe, is a very futuristic milestone for the neutrino experiments. Like it's supposed to be decades away, but maybe not impossible in the future. Cosmology, we observe it in a very indirect way. The cosmic neutrinos, during the time when the CMB is formed, at temperatures a little higher than 3,000 Kelvin, at those times, the cosmic neutrinos are a large fraction of the universe's stress energy, and they turn out to have a large gravitational effect on the CMB. It's hard to give a simple description of, like, a one-sentence description of the CMB physics, but the details of the statistics of the CMB are just generally sensitive to the stress energy of the universe at that time, including the neutrino contribution, and can constrain it very well. When we come back next time, we'll start working out the theory of this thermal history with the short-term goal in a few lectures of explaining where this prediction comes from, including the 4/11 to the 1/3. Does anyone have a quick question before we break? Okay, great. I'll see everyone tomorrow at 1, I believe.